Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 7:04 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is September 8th. And I apologize for the lateness of the time when I'm recording. Today was the day that Mrs. Tracy's containers arrived from China, so it was all hands on deck in our house, unfortunately, and that kept me away from the office for most of the late morning and early afternoon. I am very aware that this is a cultural reference that will probably bypass the majority of our subscribers, but I had a nostalgic feeling today of saving turf when I was a teenager with my parents, that it was something that is physically demanding, but was necessary, and that it was considered duty bound for our whole family to conduct. I had never had any appreciation for it when I was doing it, but then I look back on those days nostalgically, and certainly I was reminded of that today. But there we are. This has been a week in which the markets have been up and down a bit, but if we look at the weekly chart, there is almost nothing at all to report in terms of what's been happening with the S&P 500, and that is despite the fact that we have had this incredible news flow that the situation with North Korea continues to deteriorate. They continue to play their brinksmanship card, and I've mentioned previously that what I'm reminded of is one of David Attenborough's naturalist documentaries, where you get a small animal trying to make itself look bigger so that it won't get eaten up, and that's exactly what North Korea appears to be intent on doing. But of course, it wouldn't survive if it wasn't for the goodwill of China, and that remains a very clear point, that China has surrounded itself with these buffer states. The very creation of Mongolia out of northern Manchuria is another example of that. Part of the reason that they annexed Tibet is again another reason for that they want these buffer states around the core of the Han nationality within China. So I think that when we look at North Korea and everything that's going on there, that we can't but remember that China is at least partly responsible for allowing North Korea to get to this stage just by turning a blind eye to whatever it is that they're doing. But when we look at the Chinese market, I think it is perhaps not a bad place to start this broadcast, because the A-share index has been trending very mildly higher for over 18 months already, and it surmounted the 3,500 level last week, and it eased back a little bit in here today. But what is particularly noticeable is that this has been an incredibly inert environment, and that is by design. And the annual party, or excuse me, the 5-year party congress starts on October 18th. There has also been quite a bit of development this week in terms of who's likely to be to turn up to that party congress, because there have been some notable people have been left out of the invitation list. There are a number of key generals seem to have disappeared from public life and are probably being investigated, and the machinations that are going on within the Communist Party to ensure that nothing occurs to disrupt the transfer of power probably means that they're as annoyed with North Korea as anybody else is, while also being quite aware of the symbiotic relationship that the two countries have. When we look at the Hang Seng index, then it has been on a recovery trajectory for most of this year, and indeed since the beginning of 2016, and it is closing in on the 2015 highs. And If we look at that on a longer basis, perhaps looking back over 10 years, it's been subject to quite a bit of volatility, but this period of time from 2016 to now has been one of the more consistent periods, and it is somewhat overbought relative to the trend mean. There is certainly the potential for some pause and consolidation. What I've been pointing out over the course of this week and indeed last week is that we right now tend to have, I think it's easy to characterize that there are three quite common chart patterns out there in the major indices. For example, when we look at the Nasdaq 100, what we're presented with is a very consistent advance, and it is pausing in the region of a big psychological level. There are a significant number of indices are pausing in the region of big psychological levels. The S&P 500 is around the 2500 level, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is also pausing. And pardon my typing, I'm still typing as if I was typing on the Bloomberg, and I rely on David's internet connection, and they've been having trouble in South Kensington, so I'm not able to connect to the Bloomberg. But the Dow Jones is pausing around the 22,000 level, and it is quite overextended. That's what I think that's an example of one of three trend or car. Excuse me, I'm not being very distinct. This is an example of one of the three chart patterns that we're seeing. It's been one that has been doing very well, but is pausing in the region of a big psychological level and is susceptible to some pause and consolidation, not least as the likelihood of a reversion to the mean has increased because it has been doing so very well. Then, if we look at Europe, we are presented with another. And the Euro Stoxx Index is representative here. It has been engaged in a process of mean reversion for much of the last 4 months. It is back in the region of the trend mean, and there is increasing evidence that it is bouncing. And if we look at the DAX index, then we're presented with a very similar situation, and it is bouncing in a more emphatic fashion from that psychological 12,000 level and the region of the 200-day moving average. But that is then also, I think, applicable to the Nikkei in Japan. It hasn't yet demonstrated that it is about to bounce from the region of the trend mean. It is also sharing the characteristic of pulling back from a big psychological level, but it is right in the region of the trend mean, and this is a natural area where people would begin to ask, is it going to find support around here? And then we have a third trend characteristic here, and it is emphatic breakouts. And I've shown the TAIEX in Taiwan on a number of occasions, but it continues to do well here. And I think to really give it justice, we need to look at a very long-term chart, because it has not been above the 10,000 level since 1990. And 1990 is an awfully long time ago. But what this also helps to confirm, it isn't just the commodities markets that are breaking on the upside. For example, this South Africa Johannesburg All Share has broken up and out of what has been a really quite lengthy range. It's been doing nothing at all for the last 3 years, and of course that is against the background where the rand has been one of the weaker currencies, but the rand has been strengthening up. And that is also a characteristic that we see with a number of those commodity-related currencies, that they have been firming up. But when we look at, for example, in nominal terms, a number of these Latin American markets, then they are also breaking on the upside. And the Bovespa index is cruising through 70,000. It encountered resistance around this level back in 2008, but The currency has gone down an awful lot since then. It is overbought in the short term, and when we look at that chart on a weekly basis over 10 years, we can see that there have been a number of consecutive weeks on the upside. So as it approaches its all-time peak, we have to at least consider that there is the potential for some consolidation. But when we start to string together all these emerging markets and those that are commodity related, those that are leveraged towards both commodities and the rise of the global consumer, such as Indonesia, or some of those that are more developed, such as Thailand, that the Thai index has been ranging since 2013, and it is at least testing the region of that peak in here this week. But when you start to look at all of these different markets, then we are seeing an increasing number of Latin American markets breaking higher, an increasing number of commodity-related markets breaking higher, an increasing number of the original tiger economies breaking higher. The Indian market is one of those that has been in a process of pausing around the big psychological level, so it has more in common with the Nasdaq than it does with some of those emerging markets. But by and large, one of the things that is quite absent from all of these different markets is trend ending characteristics, or downtrends, or breaks, or massive reactions against the prevailing trend, or breakdowns, or or breaking of medium term progressions of higher reaction lows. We just don't see any of that. Even when we look at markets that have been, I think, perhaps weighed upon by commodity prices, then the Saudi Arabian market having collapsed from the peak in 2014 down to the towards the end of 2016, does look like it is now firming from above this 7,000 level. Even in markets where there have been grave concerns about the tone of governance, well, the Turkish market has broken really quite emphatically above that 90,000 level, and it continues to extend that advance. And that is equally true of some of the currencies that we have out there. So, for example, the Turkish lira is one of those that has been firming up, having accelerated down to those lows that we saw at the end of 2016 and the beginning of this year, and the lira continues to appreciate. And that is a pretty common characteristic. If we start to look at some of those, for example, the Asia dollar index, or the Latin American dollar index, then it's going to give us a picture of an index that has broken what was a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs all the way through until the middle of this year. Now, it was off its peak in here this week, and it has done phenomenally well of late, but this is a major break of trend, and that it does suggest that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. And of course, part of the reason that the Asian dollar index is doing so well is because of the renminbi. And the renminbi has strengthened up pretty impressively over the last few weeks, and indeed the last most of this year. But it is really quite overbought in the short term. And when we look at the dollar index, we have to consider at least that it has broken down to new reaction lows in here this week. And now the question is whether that breakdown is going to be sustained. The dollar is really quite overextended on the downside. And what I find particularly interesting this week was that Mario Draghi had his news conference, and they were a bit coy about announcing the beginning of quantitative easing. And what I found particularly interesting was during question time, and it was in the last couple of minutes of the video, he said something that really got me to thinking, and it was that there was no negative connotation to quantitative easing, and that while there were some negative connotations to negative interest rates, that the benefits far outweighed the negatives. But I think that it is too early to conclude that there are no negatives to quantitative easing, considering that central bank balance sheets continue to expand. And the fact that the ECB may announce that what their plans are for tapering in October, they probably won't begin until December or January, and nobody knows how long their tapering will take. And as long as they're tapering, it means that they are continuing to add liquidity to the market. This has been a liquidity-fueled rally all the way up from the lows that we had back in 2009. And as long as central bank balance sheets continue to expand, and they're almost up to 20 trillion at this stage, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. If we could accurately define this as a liquidity-fueled rally, then it is reasonable to expect that when that liquidity fuel runs out, that we will be then moving into a much more difficult environment. And that is something that is probably worth bearing in mind, because we're still away from when we're anywhere close to tighter monetary policy. And I think that that is something is really worth considering. There is, of course, the additional point that when we consider what the central bankers are thinking, that they are looking back on their record of the last decade, that and the way that they're thinking about themselves is that they've avoided a depression, they have contributed to a wealth effect by increasing asset prices, and that we have generally had slow but steady economic growth, that they are probably very happy with themselves. The bond market is also very happy with them because they've been buying bonds with abandon, that and they have created a market where the central bank is both the first and last resort in terms of creating demand for bonds. So it has created this incredible momentum move. But I think it is worth looking at the 10-year chart, for example, and bearing in mind that we have had yields going nowhere since 2011. And yields have been contracting for most of this year. Then the euro has also been rallying this year. And what is that telling us? I think that there is a message in there that investors, bond investors particularly, don't believe that the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates. They don't believe that inflation is going to rear its head once more. But I think that it is worth looking at a much longer term chart. Because if we look at the really long term chart of bond yields have been coming down for over 30 years. And the rise of technological innovation has been a major factor in helping to contribute to that compression in yield, because technological innovation is inherently deflationary. Then there has been, because technology has contributed to productivity, that we are getting more done with fewer people and with less hours worked. That has helped to boost corporate profits, and it has contributed to a widening income gap between those that are enfranchised by being in the right sectors, having the right education, being born at the right time, living in the right place, and those that have been disenfranchised by being born at the wrong time, by having the wrong education, by living in the wrong place, and by living or by depending on the wrong type of job. And this is unlikely to change on its own. In fact, if we look at how technology is evolving, that And I'm going to post a report today from Deutsche Bank talking about augmented reality and the new iPhone that's coming out next Tuesday, which is likely to have an augmented reality software suite embedded in it. And that is likely to realize a lot of what was anticipated might have been possible with virtual reality. There has been this battle going on between virtual reality and augmented reality, and which one was going to win that war in terms of 3D sensing. But if Apple successfully brings an augmented reality type of product to market, and it captures the imagination of investors, well, that is also going to open up additional lines of inquiry, because with augmented reality, we can have much better online shopping experiences, and then that will put further pressure on the retail sector. And certainly, I've been thinking about the online retail sector today, because the business model that my wife employs is direct from factory to consumer via Amazon, eBay, Walmart, and Etsy. And those are just venues, and you don't pay rent really until you make a sale. It's absolutely opposite to what you would have to do if you had a retail location. Regardless of where that retail location is, you have to pay up front for the rent, and then you have to hope that you're going to get the foot traffic. And that represents a significant outlay. And it's a challenged business model when you can go online, achieve the same type of sales, but only pay when you make a sale. And if you think about it in just those very simple terms, then there is no way that online retail isn't going to take over almost entirely from physical retail. And the only way that physical retail is going to survive is if it sells products that are not easily shipped, like lumber or mattresses. And that is a there's going to anything I think that can be shipped will be shipped, and that is likely to be the fate of the retail sector. That represents an existential threat for millions of families. That there are millions of people working in the retail sector. The fact that Amazon has bought Whole Foods, and that people still like to check the fruit that they want to buy before by hand before they actually commit to purchasing it. Well, that is something that will get them to continue to go to supermarkets, but probably not in the same numbers. And as younger generations come through, what they're more willing to accept the provenance and to trust companies to do their shopping for them. And I think that that is most likely to be the case. And it is interesting that Amazon posted an upside key reversal last week from just above the region of the trend mean. It did not follow through on the upside in here this week, but there is still time for it and to follow through on the upside. And it has been pausing again around this big psychological $1,000 level. And Google was another company that was pausing in the region of a big psychological level. What I find particularly interesting about Alphabet is that it has had these step sequences of reasonably lengthy ranges, and those ranges have by and large been in the order of $100. And we have just had another one of those, that it has encountered resistance around 1,000, it pulled back to 900. It also rallied impressively last week, and as long as it is doing that, then I don't think there's anybody going to be worried about Alphabet. That the most likely scenario is that it will continue to range, and then it will break upwards, and when it breaks upwards, it will likely rally by $100. And this is a rhythmic, consistent advance. And when you have a rhythmic, consistent advance, it's a trend in motion. The most likely scenario is that it will continue to do what it has been doing. And when it stops doing that, well, then we can question the imbalance between supply and demand. Then we can begin to ask questions about whether it is exhibiting type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics. But these types of companies are eroding the, I think, the ability of people to hold down jobs. They are all investing heavily in artificial intelligence. And when I first started reading about artificial intelligence, maybe a decade ago, it was said that artificial intelligence probably had the intelligence of a 2-year-old or maybe even a 3-year-old. But the most important thing about these types of computer programs is that they only have to be taught something once. Whereas with every new human, we have to teach them something new all the time. And it takes upwards of a quarter of a century to get someone up to a point where they can be employed usefully. Whereas once you've taught an artificial intelligence something, you can keep teaching them new things. And it means that today we are at a point where they probably have the intelligence of a 7 or 8 year old child. Probably not yet capable of standing in and fulfilling adult functions, but they can probably have a good try at it and perhaps affect some of the semblance of achieving the kind of functions that an adult can do. So it's inevitable that eventually they will be able to do similar things to what adults can do, and most particularly in the less skilled areas. And it is in the less skilled areas where there are millions of people employed. And as if that wasn't enough, then we also have the automation of sewing, which is developing. And that represents, again, a massive threat to millions of jobs. So there are some very clear questions that are sitting out there, because this technological innovation is wonderful for companies. They get to they get to improve their margins. What they get from technology is higher productivity per worker. They get the same job done with fewer workers, and that certainly helps to achieve a lot of their financial goals. So companies do very well out of it. And there is a certain trend that we see in a number of companies. And Adobe was one that really kicked it off. Autodesk has employed a subscription model as well. Microsoft is now employing a subscription model, so is Netflix, so is Amazon. And what they're doing is turning themselves into utilities. That they are not demanding big one-off payments from consumers, but that they are looking for, they're seeking a percentage of someone's monthly income. And I think that that is a very important change, because if people are if because we're in an environment where wages have not improved, and when we look at the year-on-year wage growth, then it's not accelerating higher. In fact, it's not going anywhere at all. It's been at 2.5% for about 6 months already, and that is lower than it was almost a year ago when it was at 2.9%. And if we look at that with about as much data as is available, this 2.5% level is rather key. It represents the upper side of the underlying base formation. If we're going to have a real chance at getting inflation moving once more, then what happens with wage growth over the next while is going to be really quite instructive. It's not going to be updated for at least another 6 weeks, so we're going to have to wait for that. But what is looking increasing, and I think this is also important because from talking to institutional investors and look and most particularly listening to the kinds of products that are being pitched to very large investors, there are rational arguments for why the number of renters is going to increase. Because, simply put, consumers will never be able to have the wherewithal to afford the down payment on a house, and that they'll be locked into a renting cycle indefinitely. And I think that that's very important. What we have is the very quickly evolving business model that is transitioning to a subscription base, where you get the same service and you pay for it over time, and but you pay for it forever. Whereas previously you would have had to have saved up in order to buy something. You're getting much more into a what I tend to think of as a utilitization of the consumer. And that's phenomenally bullish for the kinds of companies that can employ that kind of model effectively. And when we start to think about the performance of shares in that perspective, then if we look at, for example, Microsoft, then when it employed its subscription model, it really started to trend consistently. And then if we look at Adobe, well, Adobe was one of the first shares to employ a subscription model, and it has done pretty much nothing but go up since then. And of course, Netflix is a company that is on an extraordinary valuation, but and it part of the reason that it has been able to sustain that advance is because of the subscription model. Because because you have a subscription model, it's something that analysts love to see, because you don't get lumpy earnings. You get earnings that are very easy to put into an equation to project forward. And when you don't have the uncertainty about earnings, then they justify a higher multiple. And with a higher multiple, you get higher prices. And that's what's contributing to the consistency of these advances. Autodesk employed a subscription model relatively recently, back in 2016, and it has done nothing but go higher since. These are companies that are cottoning on to the fact that subscriptions are a pretty good way of getting people to commit to long-term investments in their business rather than demanding big lumpy payments on an ad hoc basis. It is particularly moving, and I think it started in the software sector. It is moving into the consumer sector. So that the number of bills that we're likely to have in future is like on a monthly basis is likely to increase. And the fact that you're already seeing in the entertainment sector that you've got the cable companies, Netflix, Disney, HBO, Hulu, they are all now competing with one another for that utility bill that people are going to pay for their entertainment. But that is, and of course, we also have our cars, our rent or mortgage, and the number of bills we're likely to have is going to increase because people, and this is the way that institutional investors are planning, is that they don't anticipate that people are going to have the wealth effect, that that technological innovation is inherently deflationary. It does contribute to higher standards of living because it gives us things and it makes our lives easier than ever before. But I think the more important point is that we're getting to a point where it is becoming a political liability. If we were to sketch out And this is a discipline that we try to foster at the chart seminar. It is to script what will the ending look like. We know what the situation is today. We know what the trend is, the trend towards the utilitization of turning the consumer into a utility is well developed. It's accelerating. It because it's already been seen to work in a larger number of companies, and it is something that we can anticipate continuing. But eventually, what we are, and I think we are just at the cusp of beginning to see a reaction to it. The reaction, and we've seen it in the UK and we've seen it in the US, is that people are upset that their wages have not increased, but the cost of living has. The cost of property has increased, the cost of education, the cost of insurance, and the cost of, and because the number of bills that we has increased, it means that our money has to be spread a little bit thinner every month in order to afford the lifestyle that we have become accustomed to. And what that is contributing to is what is referred to in the media as a rise of populism. But I don't believe that that is necessarily at the best way of considering it. I think that it is much more like a rise in reactionism, a reaction to turning the consumer into a utility. And part of the reason that I look so closely at that long-term bond yield chart is because I'm increasingly of the opinion that this long trend lower in yields, which has been going on now for 37 years, might better be described as the trend lower in the power of the consumer over or the power of the renter versus the landlord. Maybe that is the better way to think about it. And if we look back at history, then if we think about it in those terms of the renter versus the landlord, or the peasant versus the aristocrat, then eventually the tide turns. And when we think about it in those terms, then what could potentially lead to yields moving higher would be a peasant's revolt. It would be a period of time where people revolt against the reduction of their entire lives to a series of cash flows. And that is something that is, I don't think, has been probably posited yet among politicians, but it is. It has, I think, more of a likelihood of attracting the ire of voters, and particularly in future, because as we go forward, there are big questions about globalization, there are big questions about technological innovation, and what they can deliver, not just for some people, but for all people, because the natural pace of technological innovation has been that a small number of people benefited financially, but lots of people benefited. So I think perhaps there is a better way of saying that, and it is that originally what we had was everybody benefited from technological innovation, but the financial benefits were not spread equally. And that polarization has only increased over time. What I think is important to realize is that there is no sign yet that that polarization is about to change. But it will change eventually. That if we start to look forward and we think about the long term, not simply about the consistency of trends, because by and large, if we think about the three primary trends that we have right now, they're all up. And we are in a period of synchronized global economic expansion. And we're in a period of time where there is really the rise of the global consumer, and where technological innovation is really delivering on life-changing enhancements to our quality of life. And that is unlikely to change. The pace of technological innovation is accelerating. But the ability of people to pay for it isn't. And then you have this polarization between those that can pay for it and those that can't. And if the number of people who can't continues to increase, and if the number of people who are displaced by this technological innovation, not just creating a disparity, but not only, or not even a two-speed world, but a world of haves, have-everythings, and a world of have-nothings, then that is something that can lead to electoral change. So therefore, I think that the further along this trend goes, the greater the likelihood is that politics is something we are going to have to pay progressively more attention to, because the natural end to the long outperformance and dominance of the corporate sector is antitrust. We simply do not have vociferous calls for antitrust just now. But I think that that represents the greatest threat that there is out there right now. And I would be keenly aware of, or are very cautious about dismissing that threat. More than any other, I think that that is the one thing that stands out as a clear and present, or a clear and future danger for the integrity of the outperformance of stocks. When we think about the fact that treasuries have just been going down for so long, that people tend to think that it will never change. And people also tend to think that the status quo will never change. But the reality is that these types of things occur in cycles, and that we can get long cycles in the debt markets. We can get long cycles in the stock markets. And we can get long political cycles, but that they all eventually change. Nothing lasts forever. And that we have to be aware of what trend endings look like in the stock market, but also what potential trend endings look like in the political sphere. I think that at least being willing to have that discussion now will stand us in good stead for when this trend eventually does come to a head, because I think it's inevitable. I think that eventually we are going to have a situation where antitrust becomes a real topic, and not just a topic in one country, but a topic in many. And because the pace of technological innovation is occurring so quickly, I think it is important to be aware that it is likely to continue to represent a sector that is likely to outperform. The Nasdaq we've looked at already, and the biotechnology index is continuing on a recovery trajectory. That it did phenomenally well when it broke out of its base, and we've had the first big consolidation, and now we're back on a recovery footing for the biotechnology sector. And if we just simply stick with some of the larger companies, Amgen has been largely range bound since 2014, and now it is pressuring its peak once more. And I think that that is representative of a number of the larger companies, that they are pressuring previous areas of resistance, or they are breaking up out of medium-term ranges. So what we are at a point in time where biotechnology is being commercialized, and that is something that is, I think, a it's incredibly I think, optimistic at that we are getting to a point in time where people are going to be living longer. They are going to be not just living longer, but they're living healthier lives. And that we have the potential as a race or as a species to really overcome a lot of the challenges that are in front of us. But it is not going to be a straight line. There are going to be some very clear benefits, and then the question is for who? I think that is, if we tend to look at both sides of the equation, then we can be aware of what the risks are. Because when Novartis comes out with a drug that costs $500,000, then the fact that it contributes to a 90% remission rate for patients that nothing else works for is an incredible feat. But we are relying on governments or insurance companies to pony up $500,000, and that is a ridiculous amount of money, and it is putting a high price on life. And if life is priceless, then should we be putting a price on it at all? Is another way of looking at it. So I think that I don't want to labor the point, but I do think that these are types of questions that we do need to consider from a longer term perspective. If we return and think about markets, then this cyclical bull market has been going on since 2009, and we are in a period of synchronized global economic expansion. And the natural answer to that, from the perspective of central banks, is to begin to think about withdrawing liquidity. And in that sweet spot between when economic growth picks up and between when interest rates become a headwind, then that is about the most benign environment one could wish for the kinds of shares that are leveraged to global economic growth. And that is why we are getting a recovery in the commodity sector. And it is also part of the reason that we are getting a recovery in biotechnology, because it is also a cyclical sector. When eventually central bank policy becomes restrictive, well, that is going to contribute to the next recession. And when we think about the yield curve spread or unemployment as a lead indicators, then there's no evidence that we are at a point where there is likely to be a recession within the next year. In fact, probably not within the next 2 years. But we do know that there is a great deal of debt needs to be refinanced on the anniversary of the credit crisis. So in 2018 and 2019 and 2020, there is going to be a lot of debt that needs to be refinanced. And if the Federal Reserve continues to raise interest rates, then that is going to raise the price at which companies can refinance that debt. And if they are paying more to refinance debt, they are spending less on share buybacks and they are spending less on dividend increases. And that is the kind of thing that might contribute to a recessionary environment or to a bigger pullback on stock markets. And that would also fit in with the trajectory that we're seeing in the yield curve spread, where it is trending lower, but nowhere near yet, or at least 80 basis points away from becoming negative, and it could take a year and a half to get there. And that would fit with that timetable. But if that's the case, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. We can, and most particularly because when we ask the filter question, is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics? The answer is still no. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.